or spiritual worth.
After snatching some felt from the back of his shop, he hunted through the hoops for a small one and used his cooperish tricks to seal the top as tightly as any cask. I stood waiting, confused by how handsome I found him, and wondering how best to negotiate the payment. All I had was the white wampum bead from Goody Fitch. I knew that white wampum was less valuable than purple, but beyond that had no idea how this would rank against, say, the musket shot. When he finished, he held out the sealed bucket. I smiled gratefully and reached for it, but just before my hand touched it, he raised it out of reach.
"Now for the issue of payment," he said. "What have you for money?"
"Just this from my master," I said, pulling the wampum out of my drawstring bag. I offered it to him.
"'Tis a pretty bead," he said, "and a good start, but it will not cover this."
"I have nothing else," I said.
"Of course you do,"
he said in a low, meaningful voice. I felt a prickling down my spine. "I do not know what you mean," I said.
"I think you do,"
he said, staring at me. Before I could move away, he reached toward me with his free hand and clapped it around my ribcage. I reflexively pulled away, but he had me fast.
"That's a body not wearing a corset. I could tell just from how you hold yourself."
I shuddered and tried to pull away. He held on tighter.
"Your master sends you out to do his bidding, with insufficient currency, unlaced. Do you think I don't know what that means?"
"My corset is damaged," I said, trying to keep my composure. I could not hit him with the shovel as I wanted to. He had the book. I had to keep him close enough to get the book back. He laughed at my claim.
"And how does a maid's corset get damaged? Did your master damage it? I trust there was enjoyment in the damaging."
"You have completely misconstrued."
"Don't worry," he said easily. "I will not report you to Reverend Shepherd. But your master has set you up to be generous to me, in exchange for my generosity. Luckily, it is an exchange I am happy to indulge in."
He pulled me closer to him, and then wrapped his arm around my waist. I put a hand on his chest to repel him, but he mistook it as a sign of intimacy and looked pleased. I could not avoid this problem, so instead I would have to use it. "You have hit upon the truth," I said resignedly. His smile grew much broader.
"Good,"
he said. "However," I pushed on, trying to keep my voice calm. I knew it would be best to sound suggestive, but I could not quite push myself to that extreme. "I have urgent errands to attend to, and you've a barrel not yet finished. Give me the bucket now, and I will return here in an hour with the freedom to be generous." He looked even more pleased.
"After you are generous, I will give you the bucket," he declared triumphantly.
"My errand requires the bucket," I said. "But I will leave you with a wampum bead, plus a little taste of what's to come." I glanced up and down the street, but nobody was about. Knowing this was foolish, and yet necessary, I reached down and lifted my skirt halfway up my leg. I did not need to point out to him what was missing. No petticoats, no stockings, nothing but a skirt. I doubt he often saw a woman's ankle, let alone her shin. And I was flashing him up to the knee. Immediately, he pulled me against him, and I could feel him growing hard. I made myself smile. He no longer looked at all handsome to me. "I shall enjoy being generous with you," I whispered, and kissed him on the cheek.
"Blech."
At this he looked so radiant, I feared he might fancy himself in love with me. He kissed me back and released me.
"You will return," he said sternly.
"Upon my soul, I will," I answered. He gave me the bucket. I thanked him with a smile and then hurried down the lane, my heart beating so hard that I could feel it pulsing in my neck. Reader, I am relieved to inform you that the next leg of my undertaking was without incident. Although it was fucking... It was hot and dusty work. I knew I had to take the Watertown Road, the Massachusetts Avenue of later centuries, to a certain bend, where it would intercept the creek that I could follow to the boulder. Easily done. It was peculiar recognizing the boulder in a world that was otherwise so unfamiliar. The shaft of the shovel gave me a nasty splinter in the web between my thumb and forefinger, and digging the hole took longer than I'd anticipated, perhaps because my body was fatigued by the stress of the day. As I worked, I unearthed a midden, a deposit of oyster and clam shells that had apparently been left there by the natives. I buried the bucket, reburied the shells, and stomped the earth down as firmly as possible. Then, shovel in hand, slightly begrimed on face, hands, shoes, and skirts, I returned to the village. Sticking to the western wall, as far from the cooperage as possible, I hurried down to the ferry landing. Luck was with me again, for the ferry was on this shore. But of course, I had nothing to pay for passage with. Except an offer of generosity. Clearly, all the men who had been eyeing me today could tell from my posture that I was unfettered beneath my waistcoat. That accounted for their unsettling looks. Now that I understood this, perhaps I could use it to my advantage with the ferryman. Although there was his younger brother to consider, the younger brother had not eyed me. Perhaps he didn't go for girls, or was nearsighted, or was a fierce Puritan. In any case, he was in the way. I went directly to the older brother. "I'm here for my return trip," I said with a smile. He flushed slightly, so I knew I had him in the palm of my hand.
"Good day,"
he said, and held out his hand.
"Your fare?"
"I thought the earlier fare I rendered was for a two-way trip," I said. He shook his head slightly.
"Who told you such a falsehood?"
"'Tis how the service worked in my town back in England. I'm new to America, and I made a rash assumption," I said. "If I had known to ask it, sure my master would have given me more for the fare."
"Your master should have known the toll without you asking,"
said the young man. His eyes strayed very briefly to my clothed but uncorseted torso, and then back up to meet mine.
"I do not like how your master treats you,"
he said quietly. I made myself blush. I did not know I could do that until that moment. "It is my lot, for now," I said. "I erred grievously in not establishing what I would need for the ferry toll. But I pray you let me across this one time. Next time I shall be prepared." I gave him what I hoped was a doe-eyed damsel in distress look, feeling ridiculous, and very glad Tristan was not there to tease me for it. The ferryman considered me for a moment, and then moved his oar away so that I could enter the boat.
"Go on, then," he said,
both kind and grudging.
"I'll make excuses to my brother. But see that your master does not see fit to try to cousin us again."
"Cousin you?"
"He knows what he is doing, sending out an underdressed female servant as a commodity."
I blushed even more deeply, this time sincerely. "I'm astounded to hear you say it. I will speak to the minister about him." He nodded approvingly, and then gave me the same shy smile I'd enjoyed earlier in the day. How very charming. He could only allow himself to ogle me if he was certain to receive no satisfaction for it. The trip back across the Charles was uneventful, and so, too, was the long, hot walk back along the road I'd taken the cart ride on this morning. I met not a soul. The sun was starting to lengthen the shadows when I wearily returned to Goody Fitch's home. The witch was in the front room of the house, settling an iron pot over some covered coals in the hearth. It smelled mostly of vegetables and slightly of mutton, and not at all of seasonings. There was a girl, perhaps 8 years old, sitting by an open window, spinning yarn with a drop spindle, and looking bored. Her eyes lit up when she saw me.
"Mama, is this the woman?" she said.
Goody Fitch looked over her shoulder.
"Yes." And to me, "My daughter is as I am. I told her about you."
The girl, dressed almost identically to her mother, or rather identically to me since she was not yet corseted, put her spinning down and came to me with a wide-eyed, unsmiling look of reverence.
"Where have you come from?"
she asked.
"Somewhere else," said her mother almost tartly. "Children, listen, Elizabeth. They do not speak."
"Perhaps she would like to listen to me tell you about Squaw Vine," I said, eager to fulfill my part of the bargain so that she might fulfill hers by sending me home.
"Yes, but more than that. If you'll be willing to tell us more about what you are doing, we want to help you in a greater way than just this day's work."
"Really?" I asked, pleased but astonished. She gestured to the stool, now situated in the center of the room, to catch the faint cross breeze. Gratefully, I sat on it.
"I have been meditating on this matter all day," she said. "I am a settler, a pioneer. I know the importance of planning with a mind to future generations. My daughter is gifted, far more subtle with her skills than I was so young. But she will never be allowed, in this place, to show herself as she is. If you can use her, and the ones that come after her, then our coming here will perhaps have served some purpose, even if not the one I intended."
The girl plunked herself at my knees and looked up at me with an almost imploring look. "Hello, Elizabeth," I said. "I am Melisande."
"I know," said the girl. "You already told me."
I grimaced in confusion, having no memory of such a thing, and her mother frowned at her.
"I did not mean that," said the girl,
but she sounded uncertain, as if she were following a prompt that did not make sense to her. I was very fatigued, and could not think about this peculiar moment with any depth. Given this remarkably happy development, I stayed with them for the next 2 hours, explaining, in terms that would not bewilder them, the fundamental essence of Dodo. Goody Fitch, once again, fell into gales of laughter at the claim that this small-minded enclave of religious extremists could ever blossom into a force that influenced the whole globe. But all the same, she insisted her daughter listen to me. Somewhere inside, she took my descriptions to heart. We pledged mutual benevolence and peace, and as the sun came in at a blinding angle through the southern window, I prepared myself to be sent home. Diachronicle, Day 323, in which we learn quite rudely that nothing is ever simple. I was in the Odek. As before, the sudden severing of my connections to the world of 1640 Boston left me disoriented and obliged me to sit down. As I got my wits about me, I had the presence of mind to grab for the oxygen mask, just in case the chamber was full of helium. But I was naked, and soon shivering with cold. Glancing down at myself, I was delighted to see that I had brought back with me none of the dirt and dust and grime of 1640. Even the splinter from the rough-hewn shovel handle had stayed behind, although my skin was still angry-looking. My clothes, t-shirt and jeans, were nowhere in sight. I slammed a big red button that cycled the door. During the weeks of preparation for this day, the Maxis had come back in force and made a number of improvements. No longer did test subjects have to be released from the ODEC by outside helpers wearing oven mitts. Now the door opened automatically. For a moment, my nakedness must have been hidden from view by a cloud of vapor, long enough for me to snatch a blanket from a hook by the door and wrap it around me. The big room that had formerly contained the ODEC, the control panel, and everything else, had been rearranged, tidied up, and cut in half by a wall of glass. The control panel was on the other side of it. Through it, I could see Tristan, Ersebet, Rebecca, and Oda applauding and giving me the thumbs up. The Maxes had also installed a shower stall in the corner of the ODEC chamber and plumbed it with a system that would inject a sterilant into the hot water. I went in there and warmed up with a long shower, scrubbing myself all over with some manner of liquid soap that was supposed to kill all bacteria and viruses. I emerged from that to find more pills awaiting me on a stainless steel tray and swallowed those. Meanwhile, the Odek and the chamber surrounding it had been sprayed down with more disinfectant and irradiated with germ-killing purple light. I stepped out into a small dressing room where my clothes were awaiting me and put them on. Then out through another door into the control room, where I was received as a conquering hero.
"So, you have survived," said Ersebet proudly. "I knew you would. You are not like General Schneider."
Rebecca looked at me with wide eyes, shaking her head.
I don't even know what to ask you."
"That's good," I said, "because I don't even know what to say. Let's go check the site and see if it's there. I can describe the rest later." But,
"Stokes!"
came an exuberant voice from the hallway. And of course, when I exited, I was briefly embraced by Tristan, who'd been on the phone to his higher-ups in D.C., giving them the good news. It was almost exactly like being grabbed by the Cooper, but without the erection or the general sense of ickiness. I realized how tense I had truly been. There was nothing more I needed in that moment than to feel that comforting clutch. I did not say such a thing, of course. I just nodded, clapped his shoulder, and waited for him to release me.
"Tell us," he said. "Tell us all of it."
"On our way to the boulder," I said. His face lit up.
"You did it! You buried it!"
I tried not to preen. "Sure. But I want to go there while I still have a very clear sense of exactly where I buried it."
"She did it!" he shouted to the world at large. "Good work, Ethic Stokes. The professor's car is behind the building."
I could not believe how immediately overwhelmed I was by the air pollution and ambient city noises, by the seams in my blue jeans, by the squishiness of the car seat. I felt strangely bereft of something. As we drove through Central Square and up Mass Ave, I gave the four of them, Oda was driving, the clearest depiction I could of my day. Ersebet was gleeful to hear that she lived in a better time period than the poor, miserable Puritan witches.
"It heartens me to hear somebody else suffered even more than I did for being in the wrong place at the wrong time," she informed us.
We were learning to ignore her when she got like this. Finally, we arrived at the Oda's house, and the professor pulled into his driveway. An eager cluster of five, we all went through the gate into the garden and straight through to the back of the property. There was the boulder, looking more worn and slightly shorter than it had 400 years ago, but not by much, and mostly because it was now surrounded by landscaped gardens. It was almost impossible to imagine where the stream had been, but it was this near side of the rock I wanted anyhow. I recognized a particular bulge in the stone and oriented myself around it, lay on the ground and reached toward the stone, then tapped the earth below my shoulder. "It is right under here," I said. "In a sealed wooden bucket." They already had the tools for digging handy. We all dug. Even Ersebet took a mostly symbolic turn at it. An hour later, there was a hole 5 feet deep and twice that wide, obliterating Rebecca's vegetable garden. The back of the property resembled an archaeological excavation. And indeed it was. We found a rusty toy truck that looked to be from the 1950s, and some bones that looked to have been buried by a dog. Below that, the rust skeletal remains of a 19th-century lantern. Below that, as my heart beat more quickly, the broken-up oyster and clam shells I'd held in my hands 400 years ago, a few hours earlier. And that was all. There was no bucket.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
June 16th. Temperature today about 75 degrees Fahrenheit, bright and sunny, no breeze. Barometer steady. All vegetables, deceased. Flowers, largely trampled. Southside peonies, blooming. Flame azalea, blooming. And most rose bushes still in good form. South-facing herb bed, generally doing well. The garden has been completely destroyed in the interest of digging up the book Millisande says she buried 400 years ago. No sign of it. I have never seen her so distraught or confused. We stood about a large hole that had been my vegetable bed, Tristan offering condolence that at least the soil is getting aerated. Mel circling the hole, shaking her head, climbing into it, searching on her hands and knees, trying to dig even deeper with her fingers. Erzabet, Retro's chic handbag clutched to her side as usual, watching all of us with superior amusement. "Obviously not here," she said. "We have to try again on another strand. This is quite normal." Mel looked up from the hole, gave Tristan a questioning look. Tristan and Frank also swapped glances. "What do you mean by another strand?" asked Frank. She shrugged. "I mean another strand of time," she clarified, seeing their confusion. "You have your fancy technical language to explain it. I have only what it really is. There are many possibilities, and you cannot completely control which strand you are on when you are summoning. It is not up to you. Magic does not make you omnipotent." So Melisande went back on just one strand, and that one strand did not change things to your liking. Maybe she will go back on another strand, and then another, and when enough strands have been shifted a little by this, then maybe it will help here and now. "That makes my brain hurt," Mel said, sounding tired. "Do you mean I have to go back and redo everything I just did? Relive the entire day?" "Of course," said Erzabet. "Several times, most likely." Melisande groaned and threw herself onto the earth at the bottom of the hole, a dried up Ophelia. "I'd almost rather go back to working for Blevins." Erzabet, scolding. "You have a simplistic notion of how complicated things work. It is like when the euro came into being." Uncomprehending looks from all of us. "If somebody had made up a new coin and called it the euro and walked in some place to use it, it is not suddenly money. But because many people all agreed to make up a new coin, and then use these new coins over and over, now the euro is used and the old coins are not." Tristan, irritated. Bad metaphor. That was an economic policy move on the part of governmental bodies. It wasn't... It may have been decided by governmental bodies, but it did not happen. It was not real until many people stopped doing things one way and started doing them another, consciously and deliberately. Now, of course, one uses the euro. One does not think about it. Mel stood up and brushed the moist, dark soil from her jeans. Erzabet is appalled that Mel dresses like a man, and not even a proper gentleman, but a farmhand. She keeps trying to get Mel to wear dresses and lipstick. Some of her advice is not without merit, for she has tastes that are highly refined, albeit stuck in the 1950s. But today jeans were the right attire. "How many times must I redo it before it takes?" Mel asked, sounding exhausted. "I cannot say for certain, but I will try to determine because I like you," said Erzabet, reached into her bag, pulled out the frazzled mop-looking thing. "What is that?" Tristan demanded, in such a tone I realized he hadn't seen it before. "My Samalogep," she said, haughty. She began to pick through the strings, the strands of it. Tristan turned to Melisande with a questioning expression. "Calculator," Mel translated. "Not like a desk calculator, more like an accounting device." We all watched Erzabet as she selected a strand, examined it, muttered to herself, pulled it away from the mass. It was entangled with another strand near the bottom. "Yes," she said, shoving the whole thing back into her bag. "You have to go back. We will see a difference next time."
"You mean the book will be here next time?"
"Almost certainly not," Erzabet scoffed. "But we will be closer to the book being here next time." Excuse me, said Frank with his gentle smile. Would you show me how that object works? Elizabeth looked almost shocked and squeezed her arm tighter over the bag. I cannot give you my samologep, she said. I made it myself with my mother. It took years. I would sooner cut my hair off and give it to you. I don't want to keep it. I just want to look at it. It will mean nothing to you, and if you start to fiddle with it, you might change it, so no. May I ask, at least, what you use it for? He said. Mel, with a hand up from Tristan, climbed out of the hole and reached for the sweatshirt I handed her. It was early evening, and the air was beginning to cool. Elizabeth looked at the object in her hand as if Frank's question put it into an entirely new light. What do I use it for? It is a kind of cheating. She laughed a short, harsh, scold me if you dare laugh. Cheating? Every action has reactions, which have reactions. So, many consequences. You must keep track of all the possible consequences, or bad things maybe happen. Nobody has the capacity to hold that much information in her mind at once. The samologep helps me to track the possible consequences. And how does it work, exactly? Asked Frank, his face now glowing with anticipation at getting his physics itch scratched. It will be easier to show you after Melisande has done it a few times. A few times, said Mel under her breath, sounding like she had the flu. All right, but I need a decent meal first. I'll get you home, said Tristan, tossing her one of my clean gardening rags to wipe the dirt off her face. Good work, soldier. We'll try again tomorrow. Elizabeth, let's go. He looked at the hole, then at me. Sorry about the garden, ma'am. I'll call some men to come in tomorrow morning and tamp all the soil back down in there. Won't save the tomatoes, I said. Well, we need it intact so we can dig it up again, he said, almost sheepish. When they were gone, Elizabeth, now bunking with Mel, who has moved to a larger apartment, Frank and I gazed at each other through the deepening twilight over what had been the best of my cucumber patch. Such an interesting thing, that zamolagape, he said, pronouncing it wrong. I wonder if I could figure out how it works, what she's doing with it. I should have known that would be his takeaway from the entire day. Not the failure, not the future, not the ruined garden, but the interesting gadget. I thought about what was in the attic. I wished it were not in the attic. And that, being unavoidable, I wished I did not know that it was in the attic. But that glowing, boyish eagerness on his face... For more than 50 years now, I have been charmed by it. I know where to find one, I said. Stay here. I'll be right back.
Diachronicle. Day 324. Colonial Boston DTAP, 1640. In which, having not succeeded, I try again. The second time, the arrow struck me before I fell out of its way. I cried out, too dizzy and disoriented to keep quiet, and found myself remembering what Goody Fitch had said the first time. It would hit you another time. What she'd meant was, it does hit me another time. She knew. She knew I arrived here more than once. What else did she know? In a dreamlike state, I heard her shouting out to Samuel, heard her tell me not to move, waited until she came back with a blanket, and this time, a small roll of linen that she used to bandage my calf. The wound was only a superficial graze, really, enough to require tending, but not enough to lame me. Enough, however, that it would make the slog of the day even more of a slog. What followed was a 6-hour stretch of déjà vu, ameliorated by the benefit of hindsight as foresight. The witch and I had almost the same conversation we'd had before. I declined the maze, knowing what it would do to my innards. When she offered me the musket ball and piece of wampum, I begged her for a second wampum bead, and she gave it to me. I asked her if I might wear her corset, since I was going out into the world and she was not, but she declined, as she expected Goody Griggs to be by to quilt midday, and did not want to appear slovenly to a neighbor.
"Always feel free to ask me, though," she added. "Sometime. It might be available."
That was the closest she came to telling me. She knew that I was visiting her multiple times. Now the daughter's comment when I'd given her my name,
"You already told me,"
made sense, too. Once I'd returned from my tasks in Cambridge, I was determined to interview Goody Fitch, to ask her to explain her understanding of the strands, as Ersebeck called them. Perhaps if various witches described it, we could, between all their descriptions, come to grasp it. The déjà vu returned as Goodman Griggs gave me his furtive, grumbling look and drove me to the ferry. The ferryman once again ogled me, and the boys once again splashed water at each other across the Charles. With a slight limp, trudging, shovel in hand, I again strode up Water Street, into the shop where Usher and Day were arguing about the quality of the printing. The same trick worked to seal the book again. Remarkable how at ease I felt, now that I knew I would accomplish it. And finally, I approached the cooperage. I felt my pace slow. Even if I offered this unsettling fellow both of the wampum beads, one was intended for the ferry back to Muddy River, I suspected he would claim that it did not cover the fee. My real trouble was my want of a corset. But at least I knew what I was in for, and that was oddly comforting. I presented myself to him with a slight brazenness, so that at least I avoided the unpleasantness of being groped. I came near to actually teasing him, promising future generosity, before he even asked for it. I had his full attention and cooperation, and I was out of there sooner, and less grossed out, than last time. So, déjà vu continued up the road to Watertown, and into the copse of trees where the creek was, and the boulder. I took off my apron, wrapped it around my hand while I was shoveling, and thereby saved myself the splinter of the last visit. My muscles were sore from all the digging yesterday, for my body knew that to have happened yesterday, even if I was now situated long, long before yesterday. Also, I was terribly hungry, and my leg was now throbbing like a motherfucker. Throbbing badly. So I was not in good humor. I found the same Native American midden, and this time, when the hole was deep enough, tossed the shells in first, and then put the bucket in atop them. I buried it, and then in a state of filthy exhaustion limped back to the ferry, where I paid my way, and therefore had no need to even talk to the ferryman. Miserably, I dragged my fatigued butt back to Goody Fitch's, and barely had the energy to thank her or speak to her daughter. I had no energy at all to follow through on my earlier intention of interviewing her regarding the strands of time. Still, she made the same offer she had the first time, which was heartening. This time, her daughter did not say, "You already told me." I took that as a good sign. This must be the visit she'd been referring to the other time. There need be no more. Two visits should suffice. Please, God, let two suffice. Goody Fitch sent me forward to the Odeck, where I arrived shivering and naked, the superficial gash on my calf crusted and angry. I went through the decontamination procedure as before. Tristan, without the excited fanfare of the previous day, drove us back to the East Oda homestead, where Rebecca tended my wound with a salve she had whipped up herself, a combination of modern antibiotics from the pharmacy and herbs from her garden. The menfolk once again dug up the backyard. Or rather, Tristan dug, while Frank Oda watched with the interest of a schoolboy who was illicitly attending a ball game. Early that morning, Tristan had sent some men around to fill in the hole. This had further torn up the yard and made a terrible noise, as it involved the kind of pounder that is used to smooth out new asphalt laid down over potholes. The neighbors were up in arms, Rebecca told us with a sigh, although mostly she was upset about her garden. Tristan, of course, was indifferent to the controversy. Once I was sufficiently bandaged and plied with painkillers, we went downstairs and out the back to see how the digging was coming, ignoring the black and calico cats who were trying to trip us. Frank Oda was leaning against the boulder with a cup of tea. We three women stood on the small back deck of the house, staring over the railing. The midden of oyster and clam shells, which I had deliberately placed under the bucket this time, had been unearthed, yet still no bucket. As I watched, it seemed to me that my exhaustion, or perhaps a side effect of the painkillers, was affecting my eyesight, for Tristan suddenly looked slightly blurred, as if I were looking at him across a lit barbecue grill.
"You see?" said Ersebet, sounding satisfied.
She gestured casually toward Tristan.
"It's coming along." "Is he wavy?" I asked.
"He's not wavy," she said in her usual being derisive about Tristan voice.
"Something is wavy," said Rebecca decisively.
Tristan stopped digging and leaned on the shovel, breathing harder than he had yesterday, although the soil was looser and the hole was smaller. But then this time, he was the only one digging it.
"Ma'am, could I trouble you for some saline drops?" he asked Rebecca. "I've got something in my eyes."
"No, you don't," Ersebet informed him. "That's just the glimmer."
A childlike surge of excitement overrode my exhaustion briefly.
Like in old stories about witchcraft.
"You mean glamour?" I asked. For with her accent, it was difficult to tell. She shrugged.
"I don't know what it is called in old stories. We call it pishlakolo. This is glamour or something in English. I never knew the English term for it. Magic was nearly gone by the time I was fluent in your language, so there was no occasion to describe it. And now the word glamour is ruined by that magazine."
"What is it exactly?" said Tristan. "What's going on?"
"It happens because it is the spot."
Ersebet paused, then sighed noisily, as if put upon.
"When magic existed, this was common knowledge, and nobody ever had to explain it any more than you would have to explain why you sweat when you are hot or need air to breathe. But I will try."
She pressed her elbow upon the deck rail and leaned her chin into the back of one lithe hand, lips pursed, Lauren Bacall, imitating Rodin's thinker.
"This spot is where we are trying to make change. When there is no magic happening, things look normal. But when magic is happening, then what could be becomes louder or bigger than whatever currently is. That causes the glimmer. So glimmer is a good sign."
She reached into her bag, pulled out the Samologet, and began to finger certain strands with seemingly random dexterity. Then she put it away, looked directly at me, and declared,
"I think 7 more times back to this D-top without complications, and we will find a bucket when we dig for it here."
I heard myself groan before I could contain it. 7 more days of being ogled by the cooper, of digging a deep hole in virgin soil with an unwieldy shovel, of that long, swampy trudge back to Muddy River.
"And it has to be me, correct?"
I said. "We cannot swap me out for Tristan. That would be like resetting the counter to 0. She nodded.
"I'll take the next D-tap," said Tristan. "Scout's honor."
"What if the next one requires conversational Sumerian?" I asked. We waited a couple of days for my leg to heal, and then Ersebet sent me back again. And then she sent me back again. And then again, and again, and again. It was as if I inhabited a perverse universe at the intersection of Groundhog Day and a computer game. I knew what I had to do to get to the next level, so to speak. and I could do it increasingly well. But damn it, that did not release me from the requirement of repeating it. There were always slight variations, of course. For that was, in a way, the whole point of what Ersebet called the strands. They were never exact clones. They were more like a family of similar pasts that all got to vote on what their shared future was going to look like. My next visitation, the witch's house was sited slightly closer to the river. Otherwise, all was the same. But the time after that, Goodman Griggs was blind, and his son drove the cart for him. And thus, being a young man responsible for the well-being of a household, he had not been out illicitly shooting rabbits as I arrived. The time after that, it was the younger ferryman who looked at me, not the older. In that strand, the witch had only a son, but said she would pass the word on to any other witches she met. Not that there were likely to be many in such a society. The next time around, the printer Stephen Day was drunk, and as I left the shop, I heard him slur to Hezekiah Usher,
"There's something about that woman. She seems so familiar."
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
June 22nd. Temperature about 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Pleasantly humid. Slight southwest breeze. Barometer falling. Seedlings planted in container garden on front steps. Kale, lettuce, seed onions. Tea roses transplanted to south side of house to avoid further damage to root system. Hate to do that this time of year, but no choice, really. The digging continues. Tristan has ceased claiming the aeration is good for the soil, has offered to have fertilizer mixed in after the final dig. Neighbors registering complaints about the early morning noise. Cats stressed even though they are strictly inside. Today was the fifth dig. Each time we collect to watch Tristan at work, the glamour is stronger. It feels almost as if, when I attempt to look directly into the hole, some force shunts my vision aside. A very strange sensation, but Elizabeth says it is a good sign. Frank is pleased with himself for coming up with an acronym, GLAMOR, for Galvanic Liminal Aura Antecedent to Manifold Rift. I hope he is not just being optimistic. It is clearly exhausting for Mel to make these excursions day after day, but she keeps her chin up, Tristan getting increasingly agitated in a contained but obvious way. "Can you make it happen any faster?" he asked Erzabet today. Erzabet's answer, "No," and then continued as if the same conversation. "I am ready to go to Hungary now to spit on the graves of my enemies." "Tristan, we've already had this conversation. We need money. What we're doing now, that's how we get money." "I know. I was present at the rude idiot's office in Washington, D.C., when you volunteered me for this indentured servitude." A pause as he reclaimed his cool. "The sooner we're successful, the sooner we fly you to Hungary to spit on the graves of your enemies. I cannot alter the laws of the universe, even if you tell the idiot I can. But when I send back Melisande this time, I will try very hard to summon her toward a strand that is especially conducive to change. That is the most I can do."
Diachronicle. Day 335. Colonial Boston DTAP, 1640. In which I am foundationally challenged. For what I hoped might be the final repetition, I just wanted to hurry through the motions and be done with it. I realized the witch was aware of all my other visitations, but referred to them only occasionally, and only very obliquely. They were, in a sense, all happening at the same moment in time to different versions of her. And to all of her non-witch neighbors, of course. But part of what it was to be a witch, I was beginning to realize, was that all of those different versions were somehow in closer touch with one another than was the case for non-witches. So on this visit, I was less conversational, got out the door faster, finally, to my great relief, uncomfortable though it was, borrowing the witch's corset. Happily, Goodman Griggs was also leaving earlier, and his ox had more oomph to his step, as the sun had not gotten to its hottest point yet. I was over the river in record time, walked out of the shop holding the bay psalm book scant minutes later, and even the cooper was prompt and respectful, perhaps because I was finally dressed like a goody rather than a hussy. The day felt like the last fortnight of high school senior year. I had to show up, but no powers on high expected me to do anything but phone it in. I was in such a good mood, and now so familiar with the way, that truly I was operating on autopilot as I approached the creek that would lead me to the boulder. This may account for why I did not quite register that something was suddenly extremely different. The creek, which had heretofore dwindled in size and force as I approached the boulder, was now running rapidly and loudly. I looked at it and stopped in my tracks. It had been recently dredged and the banks cut back to allow for a faster flow. I was moving upriver, so looked ahead to see how far this man-made alteration went. I saw the foundation to a building. My jaw dropped open in shock. The earth and vegetation all around the boulder had been cleared for many yards, and the boulder itself incorporated into the half-built foundation, although it was, of course, much higher than the other foundation stones, high enough to be a section of wall for the ground floor. The site was unmanned at present, but there were stacks of lumber and shaped rock. Instruments and tools rested on canvas tarps, and beyond the boulder, near the stream, was an enormous mixing vessel with bags of sand around it. The stone foundation must have cost a fortune. Hewing and bringing in the stones alone would have been an ambitious undertaking. What was this thing? How could it have come out of absolutely nowhere? And what was I to do about it? Clearly, I could not bury the book here. With a sigh of resignation, I collected myself and began to slog back toward the Cambridge Palisades. The tall gates being unmanned by daylight, I let myself through and headed back to the booksellers. Merchant Usher and Printer Day had just finished arguing, with Usher apparently the victor, for Day was gloomily boxing up his stacks of books. I begged pardon and placed the bucket down so they would not think to ask about it. "What might be the building under construction up the creek, off the Watertown Road?" I asked. The merchant laughed without malice. Or humor.
"That is the most ambitious undertaking the devil ever spurred anyone to. It is to be a maple sugaring factory. A very enterprising company from back home has decided to stake a claim in the future fortune of the colony, and has determined that sugar maples are what Providence has provided to enrich us."
"The name of the company?"
"The Boston Council for Boston,"
he said. "Have you a share in it?" I asked. He shook his head.
"I was invited to invest, and I confess I was tempted to engage in something so forward-thinking. But I fear it is a bit too forward-thinking. Every joint-stock company of the New World so far has failed, or been taken over by the Crown, and I see no sign this one should fare any better. When the town requires palisades for safety, because all the American tribes are at each other's throats, and the factory is half a mile's walk outside the palisades, I fear they are doomed." "'Tis a wondrous thing," the printer said to me, dismissing Usher's concern. "Any bettering in our circumstances is to be applauded."
"Only when it is done well, Stephen," said Hezekiah gently,
as if in regretful rebuke. Thanking them, but rather flummoxed, I left the keg on the step of the booksellers, as it was not worth it to cart it back to Goody Fitch's, who would then be left with what to do with it. I took the ferry back across and walked in great agitation the now familiar route to the witch's home.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
June 28th. Temperature 70 degrees Fahrenheit, raining steadily. Seedlings. No sign of germination, but it is too soon. Flame azaleas and peonies a smidge beyond peak. Herb garden thriving. Roses seem adjusted to new spot. The rain helps. A complication has arisen in the project, that being the foundation of a factory having sprung up where this house now stands. Tristan foamed, asked us to come in to brainstorm. Frank was distracted, poking about with the quipu-like object I had brought down from the attic, and I did not want to interrupt him, so I told them to come to us. We settled in Frank's office, and I made a fire for ambience. A summer thunderstorm was passing through, and rain was lashing the windows. Melisande was exasperated, Tristan grim. Frank, curious, when brought up to speed, and questioning Elizabeth, who demonstrated boredom. Does that mean there is a parallel universe in which our house does not exist? Frank asked Elizabeth. I do not know if it is parallel. I have never measured it, she said. But clearly, something like that. If I were you, I would not try to return to that world. Why did you send me there in the first place? Mel demanded, cross. She sat closest to the fire and held her hands right above the flames, still chilled from her return. Calico trying and failing to convince her to scratch his head. You think I have control over the universe? Said Elizabeth. If I had such control, I would not have allowed magic to be ruined in the first place. There is no certainty. There is never certainty. How do we get rid of the factory? What are our options? Tristan asked. Elizabeth said, You cannot get rid of it. You can only uncreate it. Then explained that the usual means of resolving such problems is to go back to an even earlier time and prevent the conflict by slightly and multiple times altering something prior to the event in question. All shoulders in the room sagged at this notion. Could we not simply go back to 1640 and try again? I suggested. There has only been one reality in which there was a maple syrup factory, and many more in which it didn't exist. So perhaps we can simply continue the effort in another strand without the factory, sidestep the problem, so to speak. You can try that, but clearly things are tending toward the factory being there, so I recommend that you address the factory. She yawned expressively to make sure we'd noticed how dull this sort of talk was. Why? Asked Frank, who was as usual the least exasperated person in the room. Why are things tending toward the factory being built? Yes, what are the mechanics here? Demanded Tristan, almost interrupting him. There are no mechanics, said Elizabeth disdainfully. It is magic. Magic does not speak your language, Mr. Military Physicist. Study it as hard as you wish. Some part of it will always elude you. I am giving you the best advice there is. You are saying, said Tristan, patience exaggerated, that we must go back to a time before the factory was built and prevent the factory from being built. Several times. Tristan swore under his breath. All of this effort for an unreliable result is why time travel has never been a smart use of magic, she added in a superior tone. I knew it would be a terrible way to try to influence anything. Why didn't you say that when I first suggested it to Frink? Tristan demanded. Agreeing to try it was the quickest way to earn a salary, which gives me a chance to go to Hungary and spit on the graves of my enemies, she added darkly. Not all my enemies are in Hungary, you know. And with that, glanced briefly toward Mel, who was staring at her hands poised just above the flames and did not notice. I requested Elizabeth to help me with the tea, and, once alone in the kitchen with her, asked why she had shot that look at Mel. She tossed her dark hair back over one shoulder. I am only still alive because of Melisande. She is so beautiful and so very present in her young body that it is continually difficult to remember how old she really is. Is that such a bad thing? There is no benefit to my staying so long, she said. Now I am treated like Tristan Lyons's trained dog, his asset. If I had died in natural time, I would be at peace now. This, gesturing out the window toward my ruined garden plot, is not what I ever believed it would be like when I finally could perform magic again. And in the meantime, I have survived 1.5 centuries of unnatural alienation and boredom and loss. I did not know what to say. I could not blame her the bitterness. So, she continued briskly, gesturing now toward her own splendid figure in tight-waisted sundress and heeled sandals, I am going to have some enjoyment now, to make up for all those years. But even so, and here she darkened, I am only making the best of a bad situation. And I am in that situation because of Melisande Stokes. Whatever it was that happened, I'm sure she meant you no harm, I said quickly. Neither did the first photographer, said Elizabeth, and walked briskly back toward the study. I feel for her, deeply, but I wonder if she is a reliable participant in this undertaking, which is worrisome, as she is the only one involved who is irreplaceable.
Diachronicle. Days 335 to 352. Early July, Year 1. In which we are London-bound. I do not know if the Boston Council for Boston was a going concern before I stumbled across that stone foundation on the Watertown Road. But since I discovered it, it existed historically. An upstart private company of enterprising Calvinists in the original Boston, in Lincolnshire, England. It was created 25 years before the founding of the New World's Boston, and actually had nothing to do with it. Its purpose was to bring money back to its founder's local economy. An odd mixture of socialism, isolationism, and snark. The Boston Council for Boston's name really meant, Our Council for Us. Research into the Boston Council for Boston quickly revealed that in late September 1601, the company, which was otherwise about to fall apart before it had so much agreed upon an initial investment, got backing from one of its native sons, Edward Greylock, whose father had adroitly married into a family of continental bankers and, as a result, risen in prominence in Queen Elizabeth's court, albeit on the outskirts. As of 1601, the son, Sir Edward Greylock, lived primarily in London. Further research into Sir Edward showed him, and his fortune, to have cavorted a good bit with the adventurer George Clifford, Earl of Cumberland, founding member of the East India Company, which had been founded only at the end of the previous year. If Sir Edward could be persuaded to give the East India Company his coin, and not merely his society, then the Boston Council for Boston would never get the funds required to go to America, and thus never build their inconvenient syrup boiler on the road to Watertown. The next etap would have to be the City of London, 1601. This is how we met Grunia.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
July 10th. Temperature, 81 degrees Fahrenheit. Slight breeze from southwest. Barometer steady. Container garden on front steps. Kale, lettuce have germinated. Tea roses doing well in their new setting. Flame azalea almost passed. It is decided. Tristan will go to Renaissance London. I find myself relieved to be off the hook now, as I can be of no practical help. There have been long days of discussion and theorizing and research to establish a possible witch in that detap, but there is no way to know. In the absence of an individual witch to target, Tristan has proposed he be sent to a setting that is likely to attract witches. Elizabeth followed the development of this plan with some private amusement, it seemed to me. I am not at all certain that she cares whether or not we succeed. To determine the sort of place witches might be drawn to, it becomes necessary to psychologically